Mr. Brosser, when we broke off last time, you were talking about some of the officials who worked at the embassy in Tehran during the mid-60s. Who was the DCM around this time, 65 or 66?
Well, when I first came there, the DCM was Stuart Rockwell, who had made a remarkable effort to learn Farsi, and he was really quite good. He was able to converse in Farsi with various politicians and other figures that he met, perhaps not in great detail, but at least enough to impress them with the fact that he had really studied and was able to use Farsi, which was unusual, because I think he is probably the only DCM we had until much later who spoke Farsi, and that was entirely through his own efforts at the post, taking lessons every day. So then he was there for quite a period of time. I don't exactly recall when he left, but I'd have to refresh my memory as to who was there at what period, because I tend to run things together. But I think that Stuart Rockwell was there for quite a long period, maybe 4 years, something like that.
Into the period when Meyer was ambassador.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there a military attache?
And then Nicholas Thatcher came along as the next DCM. Mm-hmm. He was a very, very nice fellow, very energetic, and very easy to work with. And he was, in fact, there as DCM when I left in 66. Mm-hmm.
Who was the military attaché that was at the embassy around this time? I know there were several military attachés from the services. Is that true?
There were attachés from each service, and then there was one who was designated the defense attaché. And I can't frankly even recall at this point who the defense attaché was. Mm-hmm.
Was there a labor section at the embassy?
Yes.
Do you recall anything about who ran that shop? Or?
Well, we had a person in AID who followed labor relations. Mm-hmm. His name was David Leventow. Levintow. And he was quite good. He was not a Farsi speaker, but he had been in labor-related activities for some years and had served in other countries and was well checked out on labor issues, and he got into a great deal of information in Iran. You know, actually went out and talked to labor leaders and was really quite well aware of all the trends and tendencies in the labor movement, despite his lack of the knowledge of the language. So I think he really did quite a good job in reporting on labor relations.
Mm-hmm. But he was at the AIG staff.
Yeah.
Did the embassy have labor people?
We did not have a full-time labor person, as I recall. I mean, we followed that within the economic section, but Leventow was the only person I know who really spent pretty much full-time on labor relations. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess in the early 60s, Gratian Yaseevich was a CIA station chief.
Yes.
Was Alan Conway his successor? Is that
yes.
That's what I thought. Right. And he was there, I guess, into the late 60s? I'm not quite sure about that.
I really don't know the timing myself.
Yeah.
Because he was there when I left again in 66. Uh-huh.
Okay. Did you get much of a sense of what the CIA's main activities were? Was it like mostly counterintelligence? I guess they were concerned about the Soviet Union from an Iranian vantage point. That's my impression from. Did you get an indirect sense of what their main focus was at this time?
Well, not really, because I interacted mainly with people who were doing activities similar to mine, that is, finding out what was happening on the internal side in Iran. And we shared a lot of information back and forth as to what our contacts were saying about what was going on. Mm-hmm. It was a fairly cooperative relationship, that is, they did continue to do their own reporting, but they also shared some information with us Mm-hmm. And we occasionally debated points and would show in our reporting that there were maybe several points of view on some development. And if we couldn't resolve which was really correct, we would send them both in with an indication that one was a view from down the hall or whatever euphemism we would use. And I think that was probably useful to show that there was sometimes a divergence of opinion on issues.
So in this period, though, the CIA had its own network of contacts in the community. I mean, they had their own source of information.
And I think there was even, you could say, a sort of a friendly rivalry, that is, as to who could find out the most information using its own methods. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we, on the political section side, would be able to talk to people very openly. We could go and have lunch with them or meet them somewhere downtown or whatever and just have a chat and come back and report what we were learning about various developments. The agency people were more circumscribed in how they would make their contacts and obviously had ways of getting to sources that we didn't have, various resources at their disposal that we didn't have available, but still we always felt that there was a little bit of a rivalry as to who got the best information. And sometimes we would find out that we were even going after the same person, and we tried to avoid that, obviously, so that we would not be wasting our efforts to both contact the same person. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So as much as possible, we tried to avoid any duplication.
Hmm. Now, at our last meeting, you mentioned some of the people who you've been in touch with in the opposition, various opposition movements. You mentioned the Ayatollah Khamenei, as well as figures like Bakhtiar and Martin Daftari. What other opposition people were you in touch with? If you can remember any of the names, some of the figures from this period.
I really don't remember any other major names, because what I tried to do in general was to keep track of all the various people who in any way could be considered to be part of the opposition. Mm-hmm. And that included some people who sort of were legends in Iran for their own positions of opposition to the government. People like Muzaffar Baghai, B-A-Q-A-I, how we spelled it. Baghai had been a long time oppositionist, founded the Toiters Party, and there were all kinds of people like him who had roles in the past, but whose influence had, for one or another reason, waned by the time I was there. And so in reporting on the opposition in Iran, I tried to cover the entire range, but I didn't feel it was necessary to go to all the people and meet them personally, because some of them were inaccessible, and some of them were pretty much has-beens. Also, you have the problem of any kind of a signal that you're going to give by getting in touch with people. I mean, you have to weigh the benefits of getting information with the disadvantage of people talking about why is the American embassy sending someone to talk to Mr. X. So even though we were in touch with the opposition in those days, we had pretty much a unwritten rule that as long as it was with a junior officer, we could contact the opposition, and that was considered to be normal political reporting. The only thing that made the Shah nervous was when political counselor or high-ranking embassy officers would go and meet anybody who was considered to be even remotely anti-regime. That gave the Shah problems, but it worked out that at the lower levels of the embassy, and I was a junior officer at the time, so I could do it without any particular problem arising for the Shah or the regime. So, but still, even as I say, given that ground rule, you still had to sort of weigh the advantages or disadvantages of going to talk to certain people. And I felt with some of the contacts I had, I was able to get information enough to gauge the importance of some of these very splinter groups, you say, or unimportant groups who were worthy of mention in a long airgun about the opposition, but not worth a great deal of effort to cultivate or mm-hmm. look into in great detail. Mm-hmm. Certainly, Rahmat Movadam is someone I should mention here because he's been a long time contact of mine and other people in the embassy. He was a national fronter, but not a radical one, not one who was out in the forefront leading the national front. He tried to somewhat stay in the background, but nevertheless made no secret of his national front meanings. He was he admired Amini very much, and admired Mossadegh very much for Mossadegh's nationalistic credentials. He very much opposed our actions in restoring the Shah to power in 1953. We used to talk about it all the time. You know, every time we met him, anyone in the embassy met him, he would give us his views on that. So we knew where he was coming from. But he also was married to someone related to Alam, who was the court minister. So he had the ability to be sort of a known oppositionist, but not, he didn't go too far just to get in real trouble. And he had this sort of anchor to windward through his wife's family that could protect him if he perhaps went a little too far. Now he eventually, after I left Iran, the second time, he eventually, and in fact he was doing it just as I left, he formed a new party called the Radical Party, which was in opposition to the Shah and in favor of more rational development policies. He was an agricultural expert, and he made a lot of his analyses of Iran's problems based on agricultural problems, and as he saw it, the way the development in the provinces was being mm-hmm. improperly pushed, too much emphasis on technology brought in from the West, and not enough development with Iranian people doing it in an Iranian way. And so this is sort of the basic approach that he took. But he was, because of his National Front contacts, he was quite well aware of the opposition, and he was a valuable source for information on just background and who's important and who's not, and so on. He of course, eventually became quite a celebrity in Iran because after the revolution, he was named Governor General of Azerbaijan by Khomeini, and then he was named to the Constitutional Convention when Khomeini dictated that a new constitution was to be written for Iran. Mm-hmm. And Mogadam was one of the main leaders in that movement and was brought into it. But as the debates wore on, he took a position that there should be a separation of church and state, essentially, that the Khomeini leadership should be on the religious side, and there should be a secular government that more or less ran things that, you know, on a day-to-day basis, with contact and influence between the two, but still a degree of separation. And that was anathema to Khomeini. So eventually, his Khomeini's contacts and closest supporters began to attack Mogadam, and mm-hmm. he eventually was put on a list for interrogation, and when they came to get him, he was forewarned, he escaped, hid out in the country, and eventually got out, yeah. and now lives in California, mm-hmm. like thousands of other Iranians.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Now, when we met last time, you were mentioning that some of the opposition people told you that the U.S. should try to put pressure on the Shah to get him to relax his hold over things, or I guess to let the opposition alone in some way, if I remember you correctly.
Mm-hmm.
What are the points that they make in discussions with you? you can generalize about some of the things that they said. I told you.
Well, I think everything really boiled down to that same point they kept saying in so many different ways. They kept saying, if you're supporting the Shah, then you should have a say over how he behaves. And when he does things that are wrong or too repressive or whatever, then you should have a way to correct that. Mm-hmm. And when you said, well, this is a sovereign country and so on, they said, well, you know, as long as everyone knows you're so deeply involved in Iran, you should use your influence to improve the government. Mm-hmm. Of course, these are the same people who probably would tell their friends that the problem with Iran was that the foreigners were trying to control everything. And I would occasionally bring that up. I would say, well, look, you know, you have also told me that you're upset by the degree of foreign involvement in Iran. You're asking me to have the United States take a policy of doing more in the country to try to get the Shah to do certain things. I said, isn't that, you know, bring the opposition's point that the West is too much involved in what goes on here? Well, but the idea is the goal. The goal would be to improve the country, and if you could make the Shah relax some of his policies of wasting money on arms and so on, and start funding the money to help the people, then that would be appreciated.
Now, in general, what was the condition of opposition at this time? What was the condition of groups like the National Front? I mean, how open was their could they afford to be in their opposition? How open was the opposition generally?
It really was a situation where people could say just about as much as they wanted, but they couldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. That's how I would characterize it. I mean, they were able to demonstrate their independence of view and their opposition to the government by meeting with people, telling people what they thought in private groups and so on, which went on constantly. Mm-hmm. I think people have overestimated the power of Savak to find out what was going on in every household, in every mosque, and every store all over the country. I mean, they were not physically able to be on top of everything that was going on. So they figured as long as there was just a murmur of opposition among people and, you know, venting their anger against the government with comments to each other, even a satirical magazine, Tawfiq, was allowed to be published, which had cartoons that made fun of political developments. And, you know, there was a certain amount of unrest and opposition ferment that was allowed to go on, but if it ever then coalesced into demonstrations or strikes or anything like that, then the government came into its own and repressed these and picked up people and imprisoned them and so on. So that was more or less the unwritten rule, that you could talk about things as long as you didn't go too far. Mm-hmm. You could get in trouble by talking too much if you really made it very personal against the Shah and his family, or if you made any kind of a public statement. But as long as you did it with friends and so on, you usually were not in that much trouble. Although there were some occasional cases of people being picked up for rumors that got to some Savak source, and I don't want to, you know, minimize the danger that people had, but Iranians are very good at dissembling and telling stories. They don't like to say things very directly, but they like to use allegories and quote poetry that has a subtle point that you don't get to until you go down to layer after layer of symbolism and so on, and you get the story that basically makes a point. But if you're picked up, then you can just say, well, I was just quoting Hafez, or I was just using a beautiful line from Ferdowsi or Saadi or whatever. And so that, I think there was a lot more opposition in a talking sense, but there was not much opposition in the way of action.
Because when you think of the fear of the consequences.
Yeah.
Um, we could probably talk more about this when we get to the 70s.
Yeah.
It's much more of a visible problem.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Of course, striking for us. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
On the information that you pick up from your contacts during this period of the 60s, lead you to make any suggestions or recommendations to the ambassador or the political counselor on the U.S. final approach to Iran? Did you draw any conclusions from it that led to suggestions on your part?
Yes, but that's a very difficult point because what I came up with was probably my own thinking, a version really of what the Iranians were, that I was in touch with, were telling me. I was not quarreling with the basic thought that we still had to deal with the Shah as the de facto power, because he was.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't see the argument that we should just abandon the Shah totally as an autocrat that we'd put in power in 53 and was now, you know, not worth backing anymore, and we should just toss him out and throw our support behind some National Front group of new men, as one of the observers in our embassy called them. I didn't think that these so-called new men were really all that new. I thought that if they were in power, they would not necessarily do things all that much better than the Shah. They might just do it in their own way, and it would be, you know, different people who would be put in jail or whatever. I didn't have the feeling that there was a clear alternative to the Shah. And of course, his policy with the opposition was to keep everyone down so that there would be no one group that would rise up to prominence and get support and be a threat to him. But I did feel that we began to support the Shah to an extent that was not necessary. That is, it became embassy policy, it seemed to me, particularly before I left in 66, that whatever the Shah wanted, he was going to get.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted more arms, we found a way to figure that he could afford more, although in that time we still had these debates with the Shah. We had these formal discussions,
the
annual review, where we tried to tone down the Iranian desire for more arms, or particularly the Shah's desire for more arms. We tried to say that you couldn't afford more than X amount, and he always found a way to put in a request for more, and we always seemed to manage to push it up to the upper limits or even go over it. But I had no real quarrel with that at the time. That is, his desire for weapons had not gone into the stratosphere like it did later on, and I think he had a legitimate reason for improving the country's defenses. Don't forget that it was very much on his mind that his father was overthrown by the British Navy coming into Horamshahr and firing on Iranian gunboats, and you know, when your father's thrown out of power by the British at the beginning of World War II, you feel that one of your goals in life is to improve your country's defenses so that that kind of thing can't ever happen again. But I felt that it was going too far, for example, to respond immediately to every request the Shah had, even for such things as PL-480 wheat. I remember when I came back from Iran in 66, 67, this was one of the things that came up occasionally. He wanted some of this wheat that was for emergency uses, or there were various titles within the law to permit. There were, you know, emergency provisions, there were other provisions for when there was actual famine in the country, and there were provisions for when the supplies were short. There were various bases on which you could request wheat. But I didn't feel that the Shah had any claim to any of this low-priced wheat subsidized by the American producers, because his country needed to get organized, and they could have fed themselves well. It was my impression, if they had simply organized their agriculture properly, but it was easier to come to the United States for help. And I think there were a number of situations where the Shah expected us to do things more, automatically because he asked for them. And I felt we had to be less, how should I say it? We should be less fulsome in our help, less automatic in our help. We should evaluate things, some things we should do if they were important to the Shah and important to us, but other things that were only of importance to the Shah, we should say no. And we got into a position where we practically said yes on everything. And as I mentioned last time, the Shah sort of used our string of ambassadors there as his transmission belt to just put all of his demands on the United States and get us to do whatever he wanted.
How would you explain that? How did that relationship come about? Was the Shah's sense of his ongoing strength in terms of oil resources and stuff, or something else involved?
It was even more than that. It was his feeling of strength from the continuity that he had, because he had been in power. Although you could say at the beginning that his power base was very shaky, but at least he had been in power in a position as a leader since Roosevelt. And you think he went to Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Nixon, Carter. He just saw presidents come and go, and he maintained his power and got more and more used to running things and more adept at talking with not just ambassadors, but with congressional delegations that came. Tehran was on the circuit, where people almost every week coming through there into the 60s and 70s of various backgrounds, but the Shah was very clever at how he talked to people, and he always talked about the pincers movements that were coming around Iran, through Iraq where Soviet influence was growing, and through Afghanistan. He always pictured Iran as being about better to be taken by the Soviets if we didn't support him in every way, because he was tying himself to the free world, and it was our duty to support him. And many people took that as sort of an act of faith, that he's this great bastion of stability in that whole area of the world. And I think it was, and I wrote at the time, in as much as I could, that I thought the Shah's power was elusive. That is, the degree of control he had over the country was predicated on his levers of power, the army, the police, Savak, gendarmerie, and that the way in which he had always kept the opposition down and never let anybody have any other ideas had limited any institution building in the country, so that he was really the only institution. Everything else was pretty much just a set piece, a Potemkin village, and he was really the one who was running everything behind the scenes. I wrote that in my report. I think we mentioned that last time, the report on the political dynamics of Iran.
Yeah.
And I've never forgotten that the embassy was highly critical of this paper when it came out. And I think that it was felt that I had kept some of my opinions that I tried to voice in Tehran when I was there, kept those to myself, and then had put them into this report when I got back to Washington, and was looked upon as a sort of almost a traitor who had gone back and undermined the true message from Iran by working on this paper. Because the paper had been, as I mentioned before, had been started by Bill Miller, who was very much a pro-National Front, anti-Shah voice within the embassy when I first went to Iran. And then it was worked on further by Larry Simakis, who I think had a much more balanced view. And then I finished it up and went through all the agonies of getting it published, making whatever changes were needed to satisfy the people in INR. Mm-hmm. But then another case stands out in my mind just after that. You know, we had felt that we should be the supplier of arms to the Shah, because this at least gave us this annual review to try and only give him what he really needed, and we felt it was better for us to be the supplier than somebody else. And we obviously wanted him to be able to project a certain amount of power as long as it was used in a reasonable fashion and was appropriate to our thoughts for the area. But the Shah began to make these vague threats that if we didn't supply as much as he wanted and the kinds of things he wanted, he was going to have to go to the Soviet. Mm-hmm. And the embassy...
This is the F-4 fighter jet issue, isn't it? Maybe.
No, these were the... Well, eventually what they bought from the Soviets were the cannons and trucks and things like this. But I think this is before the F-4 issue, but I'd have to check that. Anyway, the Shah kept asking for better terms on the military assistance we were giving him. And the embassy felt that if we met his demands, that he would stay with us as a supplier. And I wrote a paper in INR, which I got approval to publish, saying that the Shah was concerned about his image in the Third World. He did not want to appear to be a creature of the Americans, and that no matter what terms he got from us, he was going to go to the Soviets to show that he was independent, that he could operate between East and West and be a sort of a third world country that could have ties in both camps. And the embassy was very upset that I published this kind of an analysis, because they felt it undercut their efforts to persuade the Shah to buy America. But I figured I was right, and indeed subsequent events were, you know, bore me out, because the Iranians did go to the Soviets and bought a lot of equipment. Mm-hmm. And I think it was purely for that reason, that the Shah did not want to let people feel that he was dependent only on the Americans.
Did you publish this open in a newspaper or something, or a magazine?
No. I'm sorry.
I misled you.
Yeah. No, I mean within the INR structure.
Yeah.
In other words, producing a report that analyzed all these factors and then made a conclusion that it's likely the Shah would buy this material anyway. And it was classified, but of course it's sent around with all over the Department of State, both in Washington and overseas, as an information type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was looked upon favorably by the embassy, again, I was taking an issue with the party line.
I see the wisdom. Hmm. I want to go back to this question about contact the opposition a little bit, because I have some more questions about some of the arms sales stuff in a few minutes. Now, you mentioned that there's sort of unwritten rules that the junior officers could talk with opposition figures, whereas senior people were supposed to stay away from them, pretty much. Was that rule ever broken in practice? Were there instances where the ambassador or political counselor met with opposition people, and that led to the problems with the Shah?
Yes, there was at least one.
Yeah.
There was at least one.
Was there Holmes or Meyer? Or? I think I remember Meyer telling me that he had some problems talking with one of the Amini's relatives at a party or something like that.
That may have been, but I was thinking of one where political counselor Martin Hertz had a meeting with a couple of people who had very definite ties to the bazaar, and also through other contacts to some opposition people, and that was mentioned by the Shah at one of the ambassador's audiences, that, you know, he was upset by learning that our political counselor had been in touch with these people, and so that was where the policy originated. And another factor along that time, that same line. We discussed last time Arsenjani and what he did on land reform and how the Shah eventually perceived him as a rival and sent him off to pasture as ambassador to Rome. After he came back to Tehran and returned to his law practice, I had been reporting land reform for some time and I was interested in meeting with Arsenjani. And I asked Julius Holmes's permission to go and talk with Arsenjani. He said, fine. So I made the appointment and went over and talked to him for a whole evening and found it fascinating, you know, and got his views on a lot of things. Obviously, he was being careful what he said, but still, it was a very worthwhile interview, I thought. And I wrote up a long airgram on it and sent it back, and that was to me an example of how the system should work. Mm-hmm. In other words, had the political counselor gone to see Arsenjani, it would have been, mm-hmm. you know, big news. Rumors all over town that Americans are talking to Arsenjani, and maybe what's up is, you know, the Iranians were just tremendous rumor mongers. You know, whatever they heard, they saw all kinds of machinations behind the scenes. They could always think of three or four tremendously complex theories that would be much more exciting than the plain truth, which might be a very simple, direct fact, but they didn't want to accept the obvious. They wanted to construct a great conspiracy theory that would be much more exciting to the rumor mill. But anyway, I could go and talk with Arsenjani and make no splash at all, because I was just a junior officer in the embassy, and that was it.
Well, by having this kind of additional labor, they were trying to, like Astor was trying to avoid those kinds of rumors. If they heard said mention Arsenjani, that would lead to rumors. They wanted to avoid that. Mm-hmm. They wanted to avoid that, basically.
Yeah.
The ambassador wanted to avoid that.
Yeah. This is our, as I say, our modus operandi. Yeah, yeah. That by doing this, that we could, the embassy could have the contacts, but at low enough level that it didn't excite anybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think was appropriate, and which when we talk later about the my second period of time in Iran, that 74-76, I think we had. Unfortunately, gone away from that precedent did not have as much access as we should have had.
But as long as from home to Meyer, this practice of junior officials' contacts with opposition people pretty much continued.
As far as I recall, but I didn't have very much time overlapping with Meyer because I left in '66.
Right. The information that you picked up from your contacts. Or did you get any sense of how much interest people in Washington had in the kind of reports that you were sending back about your meetings with opposition people and the information you gleaned from those?
We got occasional analyses of our reporting. Mm-hmm. There was even a set form that was used to evaluate reports from the field, and we would occasionally get a copy of one of these showing that someone had read what we'd written and commented on what was good or what was needed to improve it or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there was a sense of some feedback.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting.
As I mentioned the opposition, I remember that I wrote a lengthy airgram, which mm-hmm. is against back in the files there somewhere, mm-hmm. on the political opposition in Iran. And I stressed what I mentioned earlier, that there were lots and lots of people who had opposition views, and we talked about their opposition and wrote pieces and even, you know, they used poetry to make their points and everything, but there were very few people who did anything, mm-hmm. and that there was really no active opposition in the country worthy of that name. And that pretty much was left in the report, but the way so much of our reporting ended up used to bother me, because it more or less ended up saying, because the opposition is powerless and unable to really do anything about all their different views and unable to get together, therefore our only recourse is to back the Shah, because he's the only factor that keeps this country together and that makes it work. And so there seemed to be always an attempt to analyze all these other activities, but then always the conclusion was, therefore, with no option but to back the Shah fully, and he's the linchpin or the keystone or all of these terms are used all the time. And I think it became a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, really, that, you know, a lot of the reporting ended up with that conclusion, and therefore policymakers in Washington just ended up with the conclusion that there was nothing in Iran to do but support the Shah. There was never any alternative to the Shah. And I'm not saying there was in an operational sense, but I don't think that we had to go all the way to support the Shah in everything that he wanted to do.
Besides your reporting on the opposition, did you do any other reporting on political developments in the country that you looked at? Was that really your main activity through 56?
Well, the main focus was on internal developments.
Okay.
So that was pretty much my baby Greek at that time. We had a large political section, as I think I mentioned before, so we had the luxury of sort of assigning people to, you know, fairly explicit areas of activity. And so, you know, one would follow external affairs, mm-hmm. and one would follow the university scene and students and other related activities. Somebody else could follow more on what other countries were doing in Iran. That is, what, you know, keeping track of other countries' activities in Iran and their contacts. It was really quite a luxury to have so many people in the section.
That's interesting.
I read recently that during the early to mid 60s, I guess, Irish Mag provided counterinsurgency training to Iran, and it played a role in coordinating. I guess to coordinate this training, this counterinsurgency training, the U.S. country team, that's what it's called. I guess the mission and the various other U.S. agencies in Iran. The country team developed an internal security plan for the country. I guess it was a way to coordinate U.S. assistance for internal security, like counterinsurgency training and so forth. Do you remember anything about this plan, this internal security plan? Does that ring a bell?
I think the term internal security plan is probably an exaggerated one, because all I recall is a great deal of interest in civic action, which was the idea that you had this tremendous military, mm-hmm. and the way to make the military popular with the people, which it definitely was not, was to encourage them to take part in civic action. And so you had military teams going out to build roads, and you had military health teams going out to provide inoculations to school children, and, you know, the military going out to feed people when there were earthquakes or whatever. It was a great deal of effort to try to make the military more popular among village people, because traditionally the army had just been seen as a very remote activity which only touched them in negative ways. That is, conscription of their sons to go in the military, maneuvers that might go through their area and knock down crops and all sorts of things, and you know, just the whole negative perception that people thought we should try to overcome. And indeed, this became a part of the Shah's white revolution, because you remember, as we discussed, certain key points then were gradually added to, and you eventually had a 12-point reform program. But even from early on, two of the major programs were the Literacy Corps and the Health Corps. And the Literacy Corps was a brilliant idea, because what they did, in addition to using military officers to teach people in villages, they actually recruited people from high schools into uniform and then gave them special training on how to become teachers in the literacy corps, and then sent them out to villages. And it was really a tremendous step forward. I've talked to a lot of literacy corps members. I've gone into villages and visited their schools and talked to them about, you know, how it was to be in the village. And these were really agents of social change, these guys. I mean, some of them got into trouble with the authorities because they would live in a village and they would learn all the problems the village was having, and some of them tried to intercede for the villagers on various occasions, you know, go to some nearby town and talk to some official to try and get some perceived wrong righted, and sometimes they were told it was none of their damn business, you know, that they weren't sent out to get into political activities, they were sent out just to teach people how to read and write. And of course some of the better